Let's pray. Father, as we look into Revelation, we ask that you would open the eyes of our heart, that we would truly see you, Lord Jesus, in these pages, in these words, God, in these visions. Father, I pray that you would give us humility, that as we continue to go through a book that has given the church so much division and debate and discussion, Lord, that we would just want to see you and want your name known among the world, and that we would know that you are coming back to save us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. As we continue our journey through the seven visions in chapters 12 through the end of 14, we're going to come today, as we start out, by talking about the beast of the sea and the beast of the land. And as we look into these two beasts, we're going to have to deal with this number 666. Now, it's hard to even think of the book of Revelation without that number popping up into our heads. And it's become quite common in Christian culture today because of the popularization of the book of Revelation and end times movies and end times books, that 666 is almost, for some people, it's become a thing of fear, and for others, almost a joke, something that they kid about. And yet there's been this speculation on what this 666 is. Some have said that it could be integrated into social security numbers. Others have said that it could be some type of computer chip that is placed actually inside people and is used in a cashless society. Again, it's just on and on, the number of possibilities. I heard a story one time of a young man who became a Christian. And after he became a Christian, he was exposed to quite a bit of teaching on the book of Revelation, and particularly this issue of the return of Christ and what's going to happen in the Great Tribulation. And in this time of Great Tribulation, the Christians would be persecuted. And he heard this one particular teaching about the dangers of the mark of the beast, 666. Now, this young man had unfortunately done quite a bit of drugs before he was saved. And so he began to fear, due to some wild stories and theories, that somehow he had had the mark of the beast or some kind of computer chip injected into himself through the use of drugs. He became so afraid that one day, as he was driving along, he saw on a license plate a number combination 666 and began to panic. As he went to go to work that day, as he got near to where he was working, he saw on a door, again, numbers 666 on a door going into a hotel room. It just sent him into a complete panic, and the guy ends up driving hundreds of miles away and gets in a phone booth and calls his friend who led him to Christ, and his friend has to basically talk him off the ledge, get him to come back to their hometown, and so he can talk to him and just break this cycle of panic and fear. So as we look into this number, we need to, again, get our first century culture eyeglasses on, that whatever 666 means, we need to remember that it meant something to the original audience. When John was talking to this group in the Greco-Roman Empire under persecution from Rome, challenged by false teachers, really surrounded by a culture and a society that was deeply into idolatry, that somehow 666 was going to communicate something, again, about the strategy of Satan as he fights against the church. Remember, as we started off in chapter 12, that is our overall context of these seven signs or seven portents that we saw with the first vision, the woman and the dragon, was this story of the cross, that the woman represents the people of God, an Old Testament Israel, New Testament church, as it birthed the male child, the Messiah, Jesus. And yet because the dragon, Satan, could not stop the power of the cross, God's mission of redemptive plan through Jesus, he goes to make war on the woman and the woman's children, which is now the church. And so he goes to make this battle, and in chapter 13, we get to see some specific strategies of Satan, and that these two beasts, the beast of the sea and the beast of the land, are going to be two of the main ways that Satan will battle against Christians throughout the church age, or as other interpretations say, in those last 7 years before Jesus returns. So whatever 666 means, it has to plug somehow into, again, the continuing perspective in this cycle or series of sevens, the seven visions, that show us spiritual warfare, show us behind the scenes, again, the Daniel chapter 10 view of what's happening behind world leaders and powers and kings and thrones, that there's this battle going on between the forces of good and the forces of evil, this present darkness. So chapter 13, verse 1, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea, with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's. Its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? And who can fight against it?' And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword he must be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints." Now the backdrop as we look into this beast that's coming out of the sea is again looking back into the Old Testament apocalyptic prophets. And here our context will come to us out of Daniel chapter 7. And also we'll see in the next beast out of Daniel chapter 3. But in Daniel chapter 7, God is revealing to Daniel, who's been again interceding for his people who are in exile. He's been interceding for them, and God is revealing to Daniel the succession of world empires that are going to come. And yet, in this unveiling of the future, in which some would look at it and say, well, the Jews are crying out, God, are you ever going to take care of Babylon? And God says, yes, but I'm going to bring Persian Empire, and then I'm going to bring the Greek Empire, and then I'm going to bring the Roman Empire, and all of these will persecute the people of Israel, will persecute my people. And yet, at the end of the vision, we have already looked at that. The authority of the world, the authority of all the world, is going to be given to the Son of Man. That's what we saw in chapter 1. The vision of Jesus as the Son of Man is a vision of Jesus as the world leader. The vision that all dominion and power is going to be given by God over to Jesus. And that all these kingdoms, as scary as they might seem in Daniel chapter 7, are going to be crushed by the kingdom of God, which in an earlier vision in chapter 2 is pictured as a giant boulder, giant rock that comes down and crushes the statue, crushes the successive empires. Chapter 2 and chapter 7 of Daniel are parallel chapters. And so the imagery here is the sea. And the sea in Old Testament, in not only the Hebrew symbolism, but outside that in Near Eastern symbolism, is a place of evil and chaos. Remember, the oceans have not been explored and mapped. They're a place of monsters and chaos, and a place where if you go all the way to the edge, you could actually fall off one of the four corners of the earth. And so the sea is a place of evil. And so when we see beasts rising out of the sea, we know we can associate these beasts with evil. And these mythological beasts, again, are a mixture. Just like the dragon we saw in chapter 12, these mythological-like beasts are symbolic of evil. Now, in Daniel, the beasts that come out of the sea are actually fourfold. There's four beasts that come out of the sea, and one beast like a leopard, one like a lion, and again, one like a bear. And the fourth beast that comes out is different. It's terrifying. And this is the beast that is crushed, and its power is taken away eventually by the Son of Man, by Jesus Christ. Now, the difference is, in Revelation, we don't see these four successive beasts, but they're a combination. The beast that John sees in Revelation is a mixture. It's like a leopard, it's like a lion, and it's like a bear. So it's like all three of the first beasts of Daniel's vision mixed together. And yet what we're told in Daniel chapter 7, as we look into Daniel chapter 7, again, the interpretation of these many beasts is given to Daniel because he has a desire to understand what these are. And in Daniel chapter 7, starting with verse 16, he says, I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. And so he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. And as we look into Daniel 7 and the interpretation as it parallels with Daniel 2, it's not only four kings that these four beasts represents, but it's four kingdoms. And in Daniel, those four kingdoms are being talked about as Babylon, Persia, Greece, and then Rome. And then Rome kind of morphs into this kind of final beast that Jesus will destroy in his second coming. So the interpretation out of Daniel is that biblically, there's a context for beasts meaning evil world kings or evil world empires or governments. So the beast out of the sea, whatever it is most likely symbolic of evil world government. Now, some people look at chapter 13 and particularly those of the historicist view and would say that the beast coming out of the sea represents Rome. And there's no doubt that as the original readers, these seven churches of Asia Minor, read chapter 13 and they think about Daniel 7 and that beast coming out of the sea represent evil world kings and evil world empires, that for them, that evil world king is Caesar, Domitian most likely, and the evil world empire is the Roman Empire. Even more so giving to that is the fact that it talks about this beast in verse 3 and says, one of its heads seems to have had a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed and the whole earth marveled. Now, recall when we talked about the Parthians and when we talked about them in the first seal and the white horse that was coming out to conquer, remember I said that there was a rumor concerning Nero that, again, some people placed the writing of this letter in 68, 69, somewhere in that time period, just shortly after Nero was killed. He committed suicide. But remember, there's this rumor circulating throughout the Roman Empire that's talked about by Roman historians that Nero was not really dead. In fact, he'd gone over to the Parthian Empire and that he was going to come back again. And so this mortal wound that the beast have, some will take that and say it's alluding to this Neronian redux, this Neronian rumor that he was going to come back. Well, even if we can't completely associate it with that, we can associate again with the counterfeit Trinity. Recall in the last series when we were talking about this, we said that you've got God the Father on the throne, then you've got, again, Jesus, the Lamb, the Lion, and then you've got the seven spirits, the true Trinity. And yet now we're being exposed to the counterfeit Trinity, the dragon, the beast of the sea, and the beast of the land. And here we see a counterfeit resurrection. Just as Jesus was crucified and then resurrected, this beast also has a counterfeit resurrection, counterfeiting the work of Christ on the cross. And so this beast is given its power for 42 months. Again, as we looked at chapter 11, that was the same exact time period in which the outer courts were given over to the nations to trample on. That we've got these 3.5 years of the protection of the woman and the authority of the witnesses, and that's given to us in days because that's the good guys. The bad guys' reign of terror and evil is given to us in months, but they both are the 3.5 year time period. And either that is a literal 3.5 years that is part of the final seven before Jesus returns, or again, the 7 years are symbolic of the whole church age and run at the same time in that age of tension dynamic that we discussed as we looked at chapter 11. But whatever it is, we know that this beast, again, is given power by God. That the beast only has the power, just as Satan only had the power in Job 1 through 3, that God allows him to have. God is still in control. So as scary as these beasts, again, may seem to us, and as scary as these dragons may seem to us, God is still on the throne. He's on the throne in chapter 1. He's on the throne in chapter 4 and 5. He's on the throne again in chapter 8. He's on the throne again at the end of chapter 11. He's on the throne again in chapter 15. And of course, he's on the throne from chapter 20 to the end of the book. That is the repeated encouragement to these first century believers who think that Nero and Domitian and Rome is on the throne, that Satan is controlling world events. But he is not. God is in control. And the beast has power, but it's only limited, and it's only given to him, and it will end at the end of these 42 months. So he's allowed to conquer the saints, again, as we saw in the seals, in the fifth seal, even though it might be comforting us to think that we're going to be raptured or taken out of the tribulation and not have to suffer. It's not consistent. It's not consistent with church history, nor is it consistent with the book of Revelation. Just as we saw the fifth seal, the martyrs crying out under the throne, and God says to them, more martyrs are going to come before Jesus returns. So we see here that the beast does have real authority. He does have real power to physically kill the saints, to make war on them. But recall, as we went back to chapter 7, the saints are sealed eternally. The saints are going to be part of the great multitude in chapter 7 that are going to be before the throne, that are taken out of the great ordeal. So again, Satan may, through the beast, through evil governments, through Nero, through Caesar, through Domitian, kill Christians physically, but then that just promotes them to heaven, and then they live forever, where there's no more pain, no more crying, nothing that can harm them. And so this beast is allowed to have authority. And yet look who he's allowed to have authority over in verse 7. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. Now, again, kind of fast forwarding onto chapter 20. Remember in chapter 20, when we are there at the final judgment seat, in chapter 20, verse 12, and I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were open. Then another book was open, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books according to what they had done. So we know that this book of life is the book of the Lamb, and it's the book where all Christians' names are written. The other books contain the names of those whose sins have not been forgiven. They have not been reckoned as righteous. And so, again, that those books are going to condemn them to the lake of fire, but the book of life is the book that allows Christians to be forgiven, allows them to enter into the new Jerusalem, into heaven. And so what he's saying is, it's not Christians that will suddenly start worshiping this beast. We're not going to be fooled by the beast. We are not going to look at the beast and somehow be tricked into worshiping it. It says the only people that worship it are those that have not gotten their names written, who are not believers. It's only unbelievers who will be worshiping this beast. And as we will see with this second beast that arises out of the sea, for the original audience, the worship of the beast was what we call the imperial cult. This was started by Caesar Augustus as he began the empire and the changeover from the republic. He wanted to be able to further control the people, and he realized that religion was a major form of control. Now, he didn't want to stop the polytheistic worship of the Greco-Roman world. He wanted them to continue to worship the Greek gods and their national deities. But at the same time, he wanted to place Caesar on par with these other gods. And so he declared Julius Caesar, the first Caesar, to be divine, to be a god, and then declared himself so. And successive Caesars after Augustus would declare themselves the Son of God, the God's representative on earth. And because they were God on earth and divine, they were worthy of worship. And so Augustus started the imperial cult, a whole religion with priests and temples that revolved around the worship of Caesar. And so he didn't forbid people from worshiping the Greek and Roman gods and the national deities. He said, just worship Caesar in addition. And because people were already polytheistic, this was not a problem for them. They could go in, worship Apollo and Zeus and Aphrodite and Baal and all those, and then go into the temple to Caesar and offer incense on his behalf as well. And so this imperial cult had spread, particularly throughout the area of Asia Minor. Recall, as we did the background to the seven churches, that Ephesus, Pergamum, and Smyrna all had imperial temples, which means they had temples built by the people in honor of Tiberius, in honor of Caesar Augustus, with priests and the worship of Caesar. And so for the original audience, when they think of people worshiping this evil government and worshiping the beast, they think of Rome, they think of the imperial cult and Caesar worship. And so we have several alternatives when we talk about the interpretation. What is this beast? Well, again, like I said, the first interpretation that some say is this historicist view, that the beast coming out of the sea is the Roman Empire. And so chapter 13 has already been fulfilled. God gave the Roman Empire the government authority. It persecuted the saints under the reigns of Domitian, under Nero, under successive Trajan emperors, Diocletian, who would persecute the saints. But then its authority ended and God took that kingdom away. The second view is that this beast that we're dealing with is only pertaining to the time of the end. In that view, that Revelation 4 through 19 portrays the last 7 years before Jesus returns, then this beast coming out of the sea is equated with the final evil government, the final kind of, in many ways, one world government, or the major last evil leader who will be on the scene, the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, who will be persecuting the church in those last 7 years and will be destroyed when Jesus returns. Now, if this is the case, then again, we don't have a particular nation associated with this final evil world leader that we might call, again, the Antichrist, as John calls him in 1 John chapter 2. But we see him coming on the scenes shortly before Christ returns, and whatever this false resurrection sign is, perhaps he dies, he's resurrected, but it's some kind of counterfeit Jesus miracle that he claims to have had. The last option, which is a fourth option, main option, is that this beast of the sea doesn't just represent one evil government or one evil empire, but it represents them all. And again, that this 7 years is symbolic of the whole church age between the first and the second coming, then this beast out of the sea represents all evil governments. And what Jesus is trying to reveal to the church is that this is how Satan is going to battle. What can we expect as the church before Christ returns? We can expect Satan to use evil governments to persecute the saints. And this is what we've seen historically, which means that this beast out of the sea is Rome. It is Nero. It is Domitian. It is the imperial cult for our original audience. But with each successive generation, again, that beast can basically change faces, can change nationalities, but maintains its demonic and satanic purposes of persecuting the church, whether that's the Sudanese government that persecuted the believers, the Chinese government today that persecutes believers, again, whether that was Stalin, whether that was, I mean, we could go on and on into the evil world leaders and governments. And basically, yes, the cycle will end. Nero and Domitian and Rome may have been the prototype beast, the original one in which the rest were kind of patterned after, but there will be a final beast. There will be a final evil world government, a final evil world leader who will be destroyed when Jesus returns, and that is the man of lawlessness. And so that is the last particular view of it. Our next vision, our first vision again of this cycle of seven, is the woman and the dragon. The second is the beast that comes out of the sea. And the third vision that we have in this series of seven is the beast that comes out of the land. Chapter 13, verse 11. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak, and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. So this third vision, this second beast, is the beast that comes out of the land. Now, later in the book, this beast that comes out of the land, particularly in chapter 19, will be given another name, and that name is the false prophet. And so here we see a differentiation where the beast coming out of the sea represented evil government, evil kings. The beast that comes out of the land is called the evil prophet or the false prophet. And so it's to be associated with false religion or evil religion, anti-God religion, idolatry in all its different forms. And so, again, when we're thinking about the context of the original audience, for our original audience, this is the Roman imperial cult. This is Caesar worship. And particularly as we looked into the background of the seven churches, when we talked about, again, them being marked and them not being able to buy and sell, we call the persecution. As we talked about Thyatira, particularly this city that was known for its industry and its trade guilds, recall that we talked about that the trade guilds were completely associated and integrated with idolatry. And the commerce of these cities, like Ephesus, were completely integrated with idolatry. In Ephesus, the main bank and the main system of money was the Temple of Artemis. And so for business loans, for what the government was involved in, the main industry and economy was Artemis. And we see that in Acts chapter 19, because when Christianity enters Ephesus, the main people who object to it are not objecting for religious reasons, but they're the idol makers who are objecting because their economy is being hurt and transformed under the power of Christ. Remember also in the trade guilds, if you refuse to worship the god of the blacksmiths, the god of these trade guilds, then you were kicked out. You were kicked out of that and would many times lose your job. So for our original audience, they understand what it's like to be forced to try to worship the beast. We know that it's not during this particular time period, but due to a letter that we have between Pliny and Trajan, that in the second century of the Roman Empire, this Caesar worship began to be used as a litmus test for Christians. In other words, Pliny, who is a governor over this area of Asia Minor, is sending this letter to Trajan, the emperor who was definitely anti-Christian, and he writes if he should try to find the Christians, root them out, and then have them put to death. Trajan's reply is, no, don't do that necessarily, but what you can do is if Christians can be found out by the fact that they refuse to worship Caesar. And so just basically force everyone to offer some incense to Caesar. And by doing this, this will be the test where Christians, if they're true Christians, they'll refuse to offer incense to Caesar. Trajan knew that. And so this began a massive wave of slaughtering of Christians in this area of Asia Minor, only a few years after the writing of this book of Revelation. And so we can see that this was reality for our original audience. Now, again, here we reach this issue of 666, but before we get to that, let's look at, again, the pseudo nature of this counterfeit trinity. Remember, it exercises authority on behalf of the first beast, but in verse 11, it has two horns like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. So just like the beast out of the sea has its counterfeit resurrection, here the beast out of the land has these horns that are similar to the horns of Christ, represented as the lamb in chapter 5, but it speaks like a dragon, like Satan. And so as these people are marked, remember that this is also not our first mark. The mark of the beast is the one that receives the most attention. And because it makes for good movies, it makes for good TV, we forget that the first mark, remember, is in chapter 7. Because in chapter 7, remember, the 144,000 are sealed. And these are the ones that are marked on their foreheads. And as we get into chapter 14 and look at the 144,000, it reminds us again that they're sealed on their foreheads. Revelation is black and white. Apocalyptic literature is black and white. You are on God's side or you are on Satan's side. You are part of those that worship the true Trinity or you are following the counterfeit Trinity. Either it is the pure woman who has the crown and standing on the moon, or it's the whore of Babylon in 17. You're an inhabitant of heaven or an inhabitant of earth. Either you have the mark of the beast or you have the mark of God. And recall that as we went back to Ezekiel chapter 9, that this mark was not literal. It was never meant to be understood as literal. In Ezekiel 9, this mark was first placed on the believers there who would sigh and groan over the abominations that were being committed in Jerusalem and Judah shortly before God destroys it in 586 BC by the Babylonian Empire. So this mark was a symbolic mark that was similar in some ways if you've read the Frank Peretti book, The Oath. And in that book, The Oath, the character in the book is allowed to see people's evil, and that evil comes out as this brown, disgusting smelling stain. And this is the same kind of thing, that basically this mark that's on believers is not only the seal of God that says his protection, but it's saying who that person belongs to. It should be that obvious, that who we are as Christians should be so obvious that it's like having a sign or a seal on our foreheads. In a similar fashion, here we see that it should be so obvious who serves Satan and who is worshiping the beast and who is under the current and prevailing anti-God worldview that it should be like a sign on their foreheads. And no one can buy and sell. And yet in verse 18, it gives us help to understand this issue of 666. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. So whatever we say about what 666 must mean, Jesus expects us to be able to calculate this number. It's a mathematical word in the Greek that's being utilized here. Also, we know that this is the number of a man. It's the number of a person, of a man. And so whatever we say 666 to mean, it should fit with that. Now, the most basic interpretation of the number 666 would be that it's simply using the symbolic nature of numbers in apocalyptic literature. Recall that we said the number 7 used throughout the book is the kind of the divine number of completion or fulfillment. And yet 6 is one short of that. And as we saw, the sins being listed in chapter 9 in the trumpet series, there were 6 specific sins that the people refused to repent of: idolatry, murders, and so on and so forth. So 6 has become associated as the number of evil, the number of the earth, the number of man. And so all that could be meant here with 666 is that the number of this man, the number of this beast, is evil, evil, evil. In a similar fashion in chapter 4, as the living creatures flew about, they proclaimed God as holy, holy, holy. Kind of three holies to emphasize the holiness of God. So the beast is unholy, unholy, unholy. And perhaps there's nothing more specific than the numbers mean than that. The second option is that this 666 is using an ancient form of a number coding called gematria. And gematria, it was basically a means by which people would assign a numerical value to Greek or Hebrew letters of the alphabet. In other words, when they excavated the area around Pompeii in Italy, which was destroyed during the first century by Mount Vesuvius, it preserved perfectly this first century Roman city known as Pompeii. And when they've dug that out, it's given great insight into the culture of the first century in a Roman city. And one of the things they found was gematria, was this, again, this coding, numerical coding with the alphabet that was used in graffiti. That as they uncovered some of the walls around people's houses, they would find things like 545 loves 643. And what they discovered is that 545 was the gematria, the numerical value of someone's name. So if you were going to say the name Joe, but you didn't want to say Joe, you would say J equals 50, 0 equals 75, E equals 100, you'd add that together and get the total for that person's name. And so some people say that 666 is meant to be gematria of a particular person's name. Well, who would that name be? What values can we equal up? Well, there's been an Aramaic scroll found in the first century with a spelling of Nero Caesar's name. So remember, Nero is the Caesar, one of the first ones to have a program of persecution in 64, 65, 66, and 67 AD against the Christians. He was the one responsible for the beheading of Paul, for the crucifixion of Peter, a major beast if there ever was one. And on that Aramaic scroll, the spelling of his name was, again, Neron Caesar, N-R-W-N-Q-S-R. And remember, in the Hebrew, in the Semitic languages, oftentimes and particularly at this particular time with Hebrew, vowels are not used. And so Neron Caesar, or Caesar, was the spelling of his name. And if you add up the numbers, N is valued at 50, R is valued at 200, W is valued at 6, N is valued at 50, Q is valued, or K is valued at 100, S is valued at 60, and R is valued at 200. And remember that, again, this exact Aramaic spelling was used on a scroll for Nero Caesar's name, and those numbers, of course, when you add them together, get 666. Now, some of you may actually have a footnote in your Bible in which it reads that in some manuscripts it reads 616 and not 666. And this can be accounted because in Latin you would drop the N. In other words, it would be NRW. There wouldn't be the N on the end. And if you do that, you have to remove 50 from the final total, which would give you 616. So as perhaps the scroll of Revelation was being utilized by Latin speakers, they wanted the gematria to be more appropriate for Latin, and so they dropped the one N out and had to recalculate the number of the man. So does this mean, again, that the historicists are right, that 666 is standing for Nero Caesar, therefore all this has already been fulfilled? None of it applies to the future. Well, again, recall what I said is that in many ways, again, Nero was the prototype beast. Because think about it. His head has this mortal wound, and then it's healed. Now, some people may have thought that this was referring to the thought that Nero was not really dead, that he was going to come back. And yet, if Nero is just the prototype beast, if he's just the first in the line of successive world leaders who will persecute the church, then really he does keep dying and coming back to life. Even though Nero died in 68 AD, Domitian comes again on the scene. And in the 90s AD, Domitian begins the second major wave of persecution. It's basically like Nero reborn. And even though Domitian dies, then Trajan, and then Hadrian, and then again Diocletian, and then it just goes on and on and on. And so what God is trying to reveal to the church is that even though Nero dies, Domitian dies, Hitler dies, even though these world leaders die, they keep coming back to life. They keep coming back because this is how Satan is going to battle against the church all the way up until Jesus returns. And that final beast who's reborn, the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, will be destroyed by the breath of Jesus at his coming, is what Paul tells us in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And so even if 666 was meant to be kind of a code for Nero, still yet it could be symbolic of all these evil world leaders, even leading up until the final and the last beast on the earth when Jesus returns. Now, some people have said, well, why would he do the gematria in Aramaic? Why wouldn't he do it in Greek? And some have said, again, remember the persecution that is coming out. They don't want to say something directly against a Roman Caesar, and so they would use Aramaic, and it was something perhaps within that first century church, and particularly some message between John and the Church of Asia Minor, which he was the bishop over. They understood it. They had worked this code out, and it kind of protected them from directly using Nero's name. We're just not sure. Again, there is a fourth option, again, of what this particular 666 could mean, and of course that has seen its weight in theories in modern times, whether it's computer chips, whether it's credit cards, social security numbers. And again, the problem that I have with that particular interpretation is it would be pretty much meaningless to the original audience. And that just would not really fit what we see in the overall book of Revelation and the overall Bible, is that while it speaks to churches of all times, it was originally written to an audience that could understand and could, again, interpret the symbolism. It wasn't meant to be veiled until the 21st century. So these two beasts are working together. Remember the big picture. Satan, the dragon, is going to work through evil government and evil religion. He's going to work through Rome and the imperial cult. He's going to work through Stalin and communism. He's going to work through, Osama, and he's going to work through radical Islam. He's going to continue to work through false religions and false governments to persecute the church all the way up until when Jesus returns. But here we'll see the next vision. The next vision is that stark contrast. This fourth vision that we see is a stark contrast to these people. And that is the Lamb and the 144,000. Chapter 14, verse 1. And then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him the 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. And it is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb, and in their mouth no lie was found, for they are blameless. Now, again, before we get into the interpretation, see the big picture. The big picture is we've just seen the beast and the people that worship it, and the people that can only enter into its system of buying and selling if they receive its particular mark. Now, on this mountain, we're seeing the contrast. The contrast is Jesus and the people that worship him. These people also can do certain things that no one else can do. It's only these that are sealed that can sing this new song. And just like those that have the mark of the beast, these have the seal of God. And so we see the two groupings, the saints and the unbelievers, the inhabitants of heaven and the inhabitants of earth. Now, this is our second time seeing the 144,000. As we looked at chapter 7, we discussed the two main interpretations of this particular group. One being that it's a literal group, 144,000 of Jews who will be saved, become Christians, shortly before Jesus' return. The second interpretation was that the 144,000 is symbolic of all believers. 12 times 12, again times 1,000, we get the 144,000 being representative of Old and New Testament believers. And we looked at the clues that were given to us in that list of 144,000, that if it is literal and if they are meant to be just Jewish believers, that we see some things that were odd. Not only is, again, Dan missing from our list of tribes in chapter 7, but also, instead of saying Manasseh and Ephraim, it just says Manasseh and then Joseph. The order is mixed. Reuben, though he's the firstborn, is second. Judah is first. And again, remember, he only hears this number. When he actually looks to see the 144,000 in 7:9, he sees the great multitude that's from every nation, tribe, people, and language. So as we look at the picture here, we have to ask that question. Are we meant to take these 144,000 as symbolic of all believers or of just Jewish believers saved before Jesus returns? Now, look at what it says in the description about the 144,000. First of all, again, it repeats that they're sealed on their forehead. And again, we saw this in Ezekiel chapter 9 being used symbolically of those people who were standing up against the idolatry of their particular time. These are also singing a new song. In verse 3, and what is that new song? Well, most likely it's referring to the next chapter. In chapter 15, we see again this picture of the throne room of God, and all the saints are before God, and they're singing a new song, and we're told that that new song in chapter 15, verse 3, is the song of Moses. And the song of Moses is a song of redemption. Recall, as we looked at the trumpets, that basically Jesus is using the motif, the imagery of the Exodus, and bringing it into the second coming. And he's saying again, we are part of this new Exodus. And just as Moses was used by God to bring the people out of physical slavery, and after they crossed the Red Sea and the Pharaoh's army was destroyed, in Exodus chapter 15, they sing a song and Miriam dances and all the people are praising God. In the same way, when Jesus leads us out of the Exodus of our slavery here on earth, slavery to sin or slavery to this decayed, cursed creation, and leads us into heaven, the true promised land, we will again sing. We will sing a song like Moses and the people sang, because we will have been delivered by God in the ultimate and final exodus. And so they're singing this new song. Now, the next detail it gives us about the 144,000 is odd because it says in verse 4, it is these who have not defiled themselves with women. So, again, if we're taking the 144,000 literally, then we are dealing with only men, only males, and only virgins. So if we say the 144,000 are literal Jews saved at the end times, then it's only going to be male Jews, and it's only going to be male Jews who are still virgins. They can't be married. They can't have had sex with women. However, if we take this passage symbolically, then we're just talking about this aspect of not defiling themselves with women as a spiritual defilement. That not that it's saying anything wrong with sex or giving men any type of placement, but it's utilizing the symbolism of Hosea. That in Hosea, remember, he's the first prophet who got the view that God is married to his people, that God is the husband, the groom, and the church is his bride. And just as his heart was broken as they gave themselves to spiritual adultery, worshiping Baal and Hosea, so we see Paul utilizing that same imagery in Ephesians chapter 5. He says, a great mystery of marriage. And again, he talks about Jesus and the bride. And when we get to the end of this particular book, when we get to Revelation chapter 20 and 21, remember that what John sees coming, again, is prepared in 21 verse 2. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. That what we're talking about here is not only male virgins. We're talking about people who have not committed spiritual adultery. They have not, again, had sex, so to speak, committed adultery with the idolatry of this world. They've remained true to the Lord, just as Hosea did in the midst of a wicked society. The next detail it gives us is that these people have been redeemed in verse 4 from mankind as first fruits from God. And if we look at that allusion, we see in James chapter 1 verse 18 that James, as he writes to these believers, calls them the first fruits of God. First fruits being one of the festivals of the Old Testament in which as they started the harvest, the very first fruits that came onto their land was given over to God as a sign of gratitude. And that is used in the New Testament as picturesque of Christians, that we are, again, like the first fruits. And so the last detail it's given us in verse 5 is, in their mouth was no lie, for they were found blameless. So now if we're, again, taking this literally, then these men, these male virgins who are Jewish, and who have this seal and who sing this song now are completely blameless and do not lie. And so what does this mean, this not being blameless and lying? Well, it either is talking, it has to be pointing to the forgiveness of Christ, because we know that through New Testament theology and Paul and John, Peter, all of them, there is no perfect man except for Christ. There is no one who did not lie except for Jesus. There's no one who is blameless except for Christ, who lived a completely blameless, sinless life. And so the only way that we as people, Jew or Gentile, become blameless is through the forgiveness of Christ. And then through that forgiveness, we are robed. We have our identity in him. So as God looks at us spiritually, we truly have no lie. We truly are blameless because Christ has paid for our lies and paid for our blamefulness. And so whatever verse 5 means, it must be pointing to the redeemed nature, the salvation nature of the believer, whether Jewish or Gentile, no matter which interpretation that we go with. Now, once we've done these first four visions, the woman and the dragon, the beast that comes out of the sea, the beast that comes out of the land, and the lamb and the 144,000, recall that in these series of sevens, oftentimes we have a grouping of four and then a grouping of three. So we had the first four seals, which were the four horsemen, and then we had three seals, which were slightly different. Just in the first four trumpets, we had kind of a collection of judgments against the earth and created matter, and then the last three trumpets were different. They were more in the spiritual realm. Now we have our first four visions, and they're kind of belonging together, showing this spiritual battle. And now our last three visions that are given to us are the message of the three angels. Again, a grouping of three at the end. And this grouping of the three plus the harvest is really is kind of a very quick overview in some ways of the end. So our last three visions is the three angels that he sees with three messages. Then in verse 14, we have the two great harvests. And then in chapter 15, we have our last of the seven great visions, which is actually the seven angels with the seven bowls, and it spirals us into another series of seven. So we're winding down again towards the end. We, as we saw, the seals, the trumpets, and now the visions all end with the second coming of Christ. They all end with final judgment. And so in chapter 14, verse 6, "Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead, with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, 'Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who has made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of the water.' Another angel, a second, followed, saying, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality.' And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If anyone worships the beast in its image and receives a mark on his forehead or in his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, these worshippers of the beast in its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, Write this, blessed are those dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them." So our fifth vision, the fifth of these seven visions, are the three angels. And now we have kind of taken a jump, and now we are, again, winding towards the end of the cycle, which means we are approaching the second coming, the final judgment. And that's what we see. As we see the first angel flying about, it's that same gospel message that we saw in chapter 10, that bittersweet message that John had to proclaim to all nations, tribes, languages, and people. And the message is, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of judgment has come. Recall, though Jesus came to save, John 3:16, by coming, he condemned those that would reject him. And so that's the fear that's coming on those who have rejected the gospel message. The second angel gives us a preview into chapters 17 and 18. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Now we'll wait until 17 and 18 to talk about the interpretation of Babylon. What is Babylon symbolic of or stand for? But it's reminiscent of the book of Amos, and in Amos chapter 5, he compares Israel to a maiden, to a woman. And he says, fallen, fallen is maiden Israel. Again, because of that idolatry with Baal. And so Babylon as well will be fallen like maiden Israel in the time of Hosea because of its great idolatry and immorality and sin. The third angel is talking about the cup of God's wrath, and the wine of God's wrath, the cup of his anger, is going back to a similar picture that God gave the prophet Jeremiah. In Jeremiah chapter 25, we see this cup of wrath being given out to God to all the evil nations who have not only persecuted his people, but have given themselves over to immorality and to idolatry. And that cup of wrath is going to be filled up by the winepress of God's wrath that we will see in the next vision, which is the two great harvests. And those worshipers of the beast, again, we kind of see this going to be previewing chapter 16 when we see the bowls, particularly the first four bowls being poured out. We will see that those bowls fall out as drastic judgment against those who have worshipped the beast and received his mark on them. So Christians need not fear. Christians need not fear these three angels flying about with their messages, because we are not those that have to fear, because we've received the gospel message. We are not those who have to worry about being part of Babylon the Great, because we are part of the new city, the new Jerusalem. We also do not have to fear the cup of God's wrath, because we have not received the mark of the beast. We have the seal of God. And so as we get to this, this is why he's saying in verse 12, here is a call for endurance of the saints. We find, again, a call for the endurance of the saints throughout the book, seven times, in fact. Because remember the churches. As he ended each of the message to the churches, he would call them to endurance. That's the life of a believer. God never again is promising. Jesus is not promising the first century church nor any church that everything's just going to be great in this life, that we won't be persecuted. Again, remember, when Jesus came, he didn't come to save the Roman Christians from the Roman Empire or the Jewish Christians from the Jewish persecution. He came to save them from sin and to give them eternal protection. And that's why this Christian life is a life of endurance. We endure through persecution and suffering because we know what is waiting us for all eternity. And that's why blessed are those who die in the Lord, because they will not die the second death that we see in chapter 20, which is eternal death, the lake of fire. The sixth vision that we have, starting in verse 14, we've already covered in our overview of the book, and those are the two harvests. So again, as we would expect, as we reach the end of a series of sevens, we come to the end of the world as we know it. We come to the second coming of Christ, and that is represented here in the vision of the two harvests. The first harvest, we said, is done by the Son of Man, and that represents Jesus gathering the elect, as he had promised in Mark chapter 13, that he would send out again his angels to gather God's elect from the four corners of the earth. And then the second harvest, starting in verse 17, is the harvest of the unbelievers. And it's unbelievers that are put into the winepress of God's wrath, imagery that's taken or was given also to Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 63, the winepress of God's wrath. And we see blood flowing as high as a horse's bridle, right? This drastic picture of God's wrath. And then in chapter 15, the seventh vision that we have, of course, in chapter 15, verse 1, then I saw another sign in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last, for with them the wrath of God is finished. So our seventh vision actually spirals us again into the next series of sevens, which will be the seven bowls, and that's what we'll talk about in our next section. But as we bring this section of spiritual warfare to a close, chapters 12 through chapter 14, these seven great visions, remember what they reveal to us is that Satan is going to continue to battle against the church all the way until Jesus returns. We should expect opposition, we should expect persecution, and we should expect there to be continued martyrs. The beast does have power, but here's where the flip side is. So does the church. The church has eternal protection. The church is the only ones who know the song of Jesus. The church is the only ones who can endure because of an eternal perspective, that though evil governments and evil religions will arise again and again and again, the kingdom of God is a rock that will smash all of these. The Son of Man has been given authority over all of these beasts and world empires, and he will come and return and gather those that are his in the great harvest, and the rest will be cast into the winepress of God's wrath. So do not be overwhelmed at the Saddam Husseins, at the Osamas, at the Stalins, the Hitlers, at all of these evil religions, at Mormonism, at Islam, at Hinduism, that seem perhaps to be gaining power, that seem perhaps to be overwhelming and choking out the power and authority of the gospel and of Christ, because we know how this story will end, and it will end with the victory of the Lamb, the victory of the saints, that the dragon will make war as much as he wants on the woman and her children, and yet they will be protected. That is the end of the story. So don't fear 666. Don't fear the mark of the beast. We've been sealed by God and protected for all eternity.